This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to Popcast, your New York Times water tunnel number 3 of music, news, and criticism. I'm John Pareles. I'm sitting in for John Caramanica. And today we are going to talk about the wonderful new Vampire Weekend record, Only God Was Above Us.
Back on the island, water tunnel 3. Cage Sanders.
I have with me two excellent critics, Amanda Petrusich, staff writer from The New Yorker, Matthew Strauss, deputy managing editor at Pitchfork. All of us have like plunged into Vampire Weekend lore, gone down the rabbit holes, and probably have a lot of things we had to cut out of our reviews because there are too many rabbit holes. So Amanda, let me ask you first, what was your first reaction when you heard the record?
I'm very happy to be here with you guys, by the way. Excellent Vampire crew. Feels good. I loved the record on first listen. Vampire Weekend for me is almost always like a very urgent and immediate band. I don't think they're necessarily a band that takes like multiple, like it hits fast, which is part of the thrill of them. I think that the songs are really hooky. I liked the kind of looseness of the writing here. I thought the lyrics were incredibly incisive and sharp and idiosyncratic and precise. I immediately had a million stories in my head. I had a million melodies in my head. So for me, it worked really fast.
Matthews, fast acting?
Yeah, I really loved it. On my first listen, I listened to it on a snowy day, just walking around, and it felt like I was able to go back to everything that I had felt from their past records. Like they had the right amount of sentimentality, the right amount of wit and everything. And I feel like, you know, what really sold it for me on really loving the album on first listen was on the song Connect, where he sings the chickens in her bedroom. I immediately texted my wife because we have a small flock of chickens. And I was like, this is it. He's onto it again and nailing another one.
Chickens in the bedroom. I still haven't figured out what he's talking about there, but maybe you guys have the decoder ring. For me, it was like the demolition derby of noise. The way songs just whipsawed and earthquakes happen in the middle of them.
Yeah, maybe literally in the case of week of release. I think we had an actual earthquake either the day this record came out or the day before.
I definitely want to ascribe that to the rhythm section.
Yeah. It's funny you say that too, though, John. When I first listened to it, I remember thinking this record sounds to me significantly hazier, noisier than what they've done in the past. I found myself having to go back to listen to the old records to think if maybe I was just misremembering the cleanness and the crispness of some of the production on those tracks. Turned out I wasn't. I do think this is their noisiest album yet.
Diane Young is very noisy, but most of the time they're pretty undistorted. Ezra kept talking in other interviews about Cousins being the spiritual ancestor of the album. That's pretty speedy and noisy too. My favorite song by far is Connect, just because all of the crazy piano stuff. I was fascinated when they played it in Austin and the piano solo was still trying to play two dissonant overlapping lines that were clearly recorded separately when the record was made. That level of detail in their minds is one of the most amazing things about Vampire Weekend to me.
I agree. Matthew, one of the things I really appreciated in your review was that you pointed out that they're such a self-aware band. I think a very thoughtful band. It, in some ways, this record, I think, I can't remember exactly the line that was in your piece, but the record is sort of about Vampire Weekend. It's the first Vampire Weekend record about Vampire Weekend.
Yeah, I definitely felt that every time I listened to the album, whether it was saying, oh, this sounds just like that song, or, oh, he said this before. And I think it's just an important way for them to express growth, because it's easy to track the arc of their first three albums from the joy of the first one down to kind of the surrounding all of modern Vampires of the City, and then trying to ignore that with Father of the Bride, where it felt like with that album, he was trying to make an album that he would enjoy, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's an album that he's incredible at making. You know, as much as I enjoy that album, it's, I think a lot of fans would agree, it's an outlier and has some of their weaker work on it. It feels like the difference of someone accepting who they are versus who they want to be. And coming back to this album really felt like accepting who they are and fitting in who they want to be into the album.
There's also the sense they're all turning 40 this year. And I think that is a big milestone for them. They're reckoning with being grownups, you know, when they started as college kids. 40 is young from my perspective, but they've always been obsessed, as both of you wrote about, with time, with generations, with mortality. But do you think it's more so on this album?
I do. This feels very much like a midlife record to me. And I think maybe some of the musical softening goes along with that, too. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a thread of optimism, a thread of hopefulness in Ezra's lyrics on this record that to me feels like something, you know, the older you get, the more you realize what you can control and what you can't, what you can change and what you can't. And there is, I think, a piece on the other side of that once you stop trying to fix everything and realize, okay, these are the things I can manage. That idea feels very present on this album to me. And I think that's a hard won idea. And I think that's something you get to maybe around age 40, late 30s, early 40s.
There's so much history in the album, just the things that Ezra sings about. It feels like he's trying to situate himself in time and not just in a moment in time. And I think they're very aware of where they fit in a moment of time. I think, you know, a lot of bands that might have come out around the same time as them in the late 2000s sound dated to that era. Close friends and collaborators like Rah Rah Riot or the Rostam spinoff band Discovery. It's hard not to think of late 2000s, early 2010s. And I think Vampire Weekend's discography transcends that datedness. And I think with this album, they're trying to situate themselves in all of history instead of just saying, we're going to make an album that sounds like 2024, which I'm not sure at this point what 2024 sounds like.
Me neither.
And neither is Ezra, because I asked him. He said it was above his pay grade. One thing I learned from Ariel Rexshade when I talked to him about the album is that he claimed that the guitars on this album are all recorded direct, guitar effect, digital interface, no amps. He said he'd been making albums with amplifiers all these years and that the way he wanted rock to sound in 2024 was different. I'm not sure he's strictly speaking correct, because Ice Cream Piano starts with amplifier hum.
Yeah.
But maybe that's the one and only spot. But I thought it was interesting that he was bringing a technical spec to the kind of sound he wanted.
That's really interesting. Something both of you have mentioned now is almost the kind of relative timelessness of this band. I mean, to me, they've always felt a little untethered from their time and place. They didn't sound like anything else in 2006. I don't think they sound like any other band now. I think that's maybe why they're a bit divisive, too. I don't know if you guys have gotten any gentle ribbing from your friends for riding hard for Vampire Weekend. I have. It sometimes feels like they're almost an embarrassing band to like because people dislike them so vehemently. But I've always loved that they feel a little out of step with everything that's going on around them. It's always made them a really interesting band for me in that way.
I think you pulling out that technical detail of just knowing how to hook up the guitars or how to record that is something that I'm not sure how many bands are thinking of it conceptually in that way. That I think just the concept of their music has always been important to them. And it even reminds me of, again, of Father of the Bride, of it's almost like a distorted take on jam music of just, we're going to plug it in and go and see where it goes from there.
Speaking of jam music, they just recorded the 30-minute version of Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa with Goose, which I listened to this morning. But the incredible level of self-consciousness, because their email, I think, is 8-minute Kwasa. So now they've recorded a 30-minute Kwasa. Is any band more self-conscious than this?
Maybe not. They're an incredibly self-aware group. I mean, I think of the track Unbearably White from Father of the Bride, which, of course, it is not a song about whiteness by any stretch in the sort of racial sense. But I think the title was a kind of winking nod to, you know, a criticism many people had of their work early on and their sort of appropriation of this kind of Graceland-esque polyrhythm. I think they're a band that reads their press. And in fact, John, maybe it was in your interview with them where they even said as much, right? They have followed the kind of critical narrative about their work from the get-go, and it has informed some of the choices that they've made for sure.
I don't know if this is necessarily good for a band. I'm a don't read the comments kind of person.
Yeah, very healthy, very wise, very healthy.
Ezra's been so voluble and he's doing that internet radio show. They're so self-conscious about music. One thing that amazes me is how you escape the self-consciousness to be as nutty as this album gets. Matthew, you have a favorite song?
Yeah, I think my favorite song on the album is Mary Boone. I think it's just a really pretty composition. And to me, it just feels very human in a way that they've often shied away from. If I were to go back and think of what song it reminds me of the most, it would be Yah Hey. And he's gone from singing to God and pleading about what life means and what the world is to writing a metaphor about a criminal art dealer and just asking simply or saying simply, like, I hope that you find love soon. And as with any good Ezra song, I just love all the recitation, just Ondo Churches and Whirling Dervishes. He just has such a way with knowing how to write lyrics that fit how he sings and fit his voice. That's delicate, as you wrote, Amanda, like quite consonant. And it's just not something you'll hear from a lot of other bands where if you were to say, what's your favorite lyric? And you just recite Ondo Churches and Whirling Dervishes and all that over and over. It's hard to pinpoint what it means, but it means something beyond just what he's calling out.
That verse is the helicopter shot of the song. He's talking about trying to make it in the art world, and then suddenly he's into all these devotional images. Speaking of devotional, I mean, Modern Vampires was arguing with himself, it seemed, about faith and belief and community. This one still has it, but in more subtle ways, I think. Mandy, you wrote about this a bit.
Modern Vampires is my favorite Vampire Weekend record. I like them all. For me, it's a very solid 5-record run. But that one is my favorite. And I think in part because those questions feel very earnest to me. I think with a band this self-aware, as we were saying, sometimes that kind of true vulnerability can get a little bit lost in the knowing, in the self-awareness. But for me, Modern Vampires, I think that questioning of, can I submit to a divine idea? Can I be subsumed by this larger force? Can I be made to serve a master, as Ezra sings? To me, that felt very true and very beautiful. And I responded enormously to that idea. But I think it's been a kind of a thread in their discography throughout. I mean, obviously, from the title on down, there's quite a bit of religious imagery, religious references on this record, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And hope is a hymn.
Yeah.
If it's anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were you surprised by Hope, Matthew? You've clocked all their songs previously.
Probably the one I listen to least because it feels like a real commitment to go into. Like, you have to hear all of the fury that he's going through and let it go. It's funny. It reminds me of Leonard Cohen's Death of a Ladies Man, not really in content, but just this epic closing an album that has a little less to do with everything else that came before it. And it just feels like you're, you know, kneeling at the altar and trying to get into the head of what this person's been trying to communicate for the last 30, 40 minutes. But it's just so much more calm and gentle. And there's so much grace to the song, and it just sounds like something he came up with sitting around a campfire, as they do on that new Vampire Campfire podcast.
John, I'm curious, do you have a favorite? Which is your favorite of the records?
Of the records, I'm split between this and Modern Vampires. I pretty much agree with you. It might be Modern Vampires, but I might change in 6 months.
Yeah. Matthew?
It's hard to argue with how important Modern Vampires is. It's almost like the other records wouldn't matter if that one weren't such a success, because they had to prove that they had this masterpiece within them. But I often find myself going to Contra just for like a quick record, gets in and out, has some great songs. And I also love this new one and could see it in time becoming my favorite. I just, with decades spent with the other albums, it doesn't feel fair to call this one my favorite yet.
Contra was the last one with only 10 songs. And then apparently Ezra agonized over maybe putting in an 11th song on this album and then ruled against it. But they're very aware of the format of an album as X number of songs.
Contra was the last gasp, too, of the ska punk influence, maybe. I feel like that was so heavy in those first two records. And in fact, probably people who are casual Vampire Weekend fans, probably Holiday and A-Punk are the songs they know best. That to me, I think, is maybe the sort of least favorite component of what they do.
They stopped sounding like a band that was extending 90s rock. They did say the Farfisa Oregon and Prep School Gangsters is a callback to ska bands.
Oh, cool. I like that song a lot. That's one of my favorite tracks.
Looking to sell your car? Carvana makes it easy. Enter your license plate or VIN, answer a few quick questions, and you can get a real offer that is good for 7 days in just minutes. That's not all. Carvana is dedicated to making car selling easy. No need to get up. Carvana will pick up your car from your home after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to sell your car without ever leaving the comfort of home.
I'm David Marchese.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And we're the hosts of The Interview from The New York Times.
David and I have spent our careers interviewing some of the most interesting and influential people in the world.
Which means we know when to ask tough questions and when to just sit back and listen.
And now we've teamed up to have these conversations every week. We'll try to reveal something about the people shaping our world.
And we'll get some great stories from them, too.
It's The Interview from The New York Times. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
There's another anecdote I couldn't fit into the interview, which was that Prep School Gangsters credit to Dev Hynes on drums. Apparently, he had one arm in a sling because it was broken. So he was playing that drum beat on a drop into the studio with one arm.
Ah, that's so sick.
And they knew to use it. The other thing that kind of fascinated me talking to them is how they go back into the archaeology of their old recordings. Gen X Cops apparently is a 10 or 12 year old guitar lick that Chris Thompson played, and somebody remembered it and thought, oh, let's build a song around that a decade later. The mental cataloging of every riff you've ever played impresses me. Let's put it that way.
I thought that was wild when I read that. Maybe in your piece, John, or maybe it was something they mentioned on their podcast. But whenever you hear about a band dipping too deep into the archives, I think sometimes it can cause some fear and concern that maybe the creative well is a little bit low. But I think that Vampire Weekend's just too smart for that. You know, I think they're too savvy. I think they kind of know when the time is right for a certain melody, a certain riff. It's extraordinary. I love that song, too. So I'm glad they dug it up.
Matthew, you've written a lot about the cross-referentiality. Do you have a favorite callback on this album?
Just listening to Connect, and every time you can hear the Mansard Roof drum fill, just I need to stop myself, add Mansard Roof to my queue, and go and listen to that. And just why they would consider doing that, you know, what's the importance to them and why that particular drum fill, and even just trying to figure out where it fits in I thought for the longest time when I was listening to it that it was Holiday. And then I think it just sounds like Holiday as a song and what it means to build these pieces out of your past catalog. And I think that was something they've done even on Modern Vampires and Father of the Bride with Modern Vampires, where they sing of the chandelier as coming down. It's, of course, feels like they're talking about their first album. Then Father of the Bride going back to that same fingerback song and saying, I don't want to live like this, but I don't want to die. It's just always been important for them to look at who they are and how they've changed and how they could take what they were once saying and make it mean something new.
Another thing about this album is they're thinking about, maybe it's the turning 40 thing, but they're thinking about generations. There's Gen X cops, there's prep school gangsters. They're very much, Ezra became a father. So they're very much thinking about continuity and inheritance, legacies, including their own.
Yeah, I think about that line in Mary Boone, was it all in vain? We always wanted money. Now the money's not the same. There is that feeling of this is a band on the other side in some ways, colossal success and figuring out what it means now, you know, what it means now that you're a little bit older. You're not the cool young band just on the ascendant. Yeah, I think there's a lot of thoughtfulness. I also became a parent between when Modern Vampires came out and between when this record came out. And I think I really related to a lot of the ways in which Ezra was sort of phrasing that idea, the way it changes your worldview, the way it changes the way you think about generational inheritance, the way it changes the way you think about the direction of the world, and also your powerlessness in the face of all of that. It all really resonated for me.
There's classical, too, where they're thinking about history.
I think there's a subtext on this record of nobody is innocent. There's this idea that we're all carrying the mistakes that our ancestors made in a way. And that can be a heavy idea, but I think also in some ways a freeing one, because we're all just trying to do the best we can right now.
Indeed. Another cutting room floor interview tidbit was Pravda, which talks about Ezra's Russian immigrant family. That balalaika he sings about is real, and Pravda is the Russian newspaper, it means truth. But he played it for a friend of his, he said, and the friend said, oh, Pravda, the bar, which was a famous nightlife.
A vodka bar, yeah.
So I figured that a songwriter gets everything they put into the song and everything everybody adds to it.
I took the family balalaika. The strings would never stay in tune.
Pravda was one of those sort of weird New York institutions, I think, for a time. And Vampire Weekend, even though they all live in L.A. now, they're still such a New York band. This is such a New York record from the cover on through. I feel like, you know, a person would be forgiven for hearing that word and thinking it was yet another allusion to some spot in the city.
There's also the tunnel theme of this album. Water Tunnel Number 3, Mary Boone has a lot of bridge and tunnel traffic. He told me he was thinking about just what's under the city, the literal network of steam and subway and water tunnels. We do have to talk about Water Tunnel Number 3, which is the world's longest running construction project, apparently. It's supposed to bring water from upstate to New York City. He saw a New Yorker story about it, but his father was also his father became a set designer, but his father was previously an engineer and was fascinated by tunnels. He mentioned Sandhogs on the album. The idea of all of this hidden but so difficult construction, I actually think it's a metaphor for the way Vampire Weekend builds songs. There's so much under the surface that's just hard to do and taken for granted.
That's really smart, John. You should be a music critic.
I got to get a real job someday.
I think that's so true. I hadn't thought about it in that way. But I think that is, yeah, that feels very apt and very true to me. And also that idea, I mean, you were mentioning the bridge and tunnel traffic. I think there's some very funny and great lyrics on here about New Jersey and Brooklyn and Queens and the sort of orbiting the city, these kind of satellite places in a funny way, trying to get to where the action is. That feels very true to their whole sort of gestalt. I noticed they were on, I think it was The Daily Show maybe a few days ago, and they were asked about how living in Los Angeles has changed their psychology as a band. And they didn't really answer the question. John, I'm curious if that's something they talked to you about, because it's something, this is such a New York record by these three guys who now live in LA. I want to unpack that tension more, though I can't quite figure it out myself.
Sometimes escaping a place makes you think about it more.
Yeah.
What they did talk about was jamming through the early pandemic. And in their former medical office mini mall studios, which I think would have been, I guess you could do it in New York, but jamming in a mini mall seems more like LA to me.
Yeah.
I related a lot to this record as an ex-New Yorker. I'm a native Long Islander and I lived in the city for 10 years. And I've been out west in Denver for 4 years now. But like you were saying, with how obsessed they still are with New York, I feel the same way. I work in New York, I have friends in New York, and it just makes you view the city in a way that isn't there at the moment, or at least doesn't always feel that way at the moment. When I go there now, I'm struck by all the billboards and struck by all the people and all the smells and all the things that a New Yorker would experience that you just become a nerd to when you live there. And I think being apart from it, you can see the weirder parts of the city for what it is instead of just taking it for granted. And that's, you know, with things like Water Tunnel 3 or even just the imagery that goes with the album cover. Great photos that show the subway as this strange place, or the single art for Capricorn and Gen X Cops was a photo that he took that I think was pointedly taken from Hoboken looking out at the old Twin Towers. Ezra, being a New Yorker, moved to New Jersey, raised there, back in the city, gone again, and just how the city will always look as an outsider, as this surreal place.
There's also memories of the 80s in this album, when they were just kids. I do remember New York in the 80s as a jumping place for artists, as a place where artists could actually settle and make a living, not have to worry about skyrocketing rents, where the Talking Heads could have a $220 a month loft on Ludlow Street. The 80s were the tail end of that. But I think he's channeling memories from when he was barely alive. Let's pick another song and go deep. What do you suggest? Should we talk about Capricorn? Are there Capricorn fans in the house?
I am both an actual Capricorn and also a Capricorn fan. That I think Capricorn and Mary Boone are my two favorite tracks on the record.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
There's a real sweetness, I think, to Capricorn that worked on me. I think it's a gentle song. It's a lovely song. It's wistful. It's hazy. It moves in a kind of unusual way. I don't know. Do you guys like it? Is it just because I'm a Capricorn? Was it just speaking directly to my astrological proclivities?
I think it's a really pretty song, and one that they don't really make. They don't make that many love devotional ballads, and it's just simple. As you wrote well in your review, Amanda, there's not a lot more you could say to someone that's a lot sweeter than "You Don't Have to Try." And I think that captures a lot of what is great about him as a songwriter, is just being small and precise with these thoughts and feelings instead of shooting for the rafters or saying something trite.
That song also, it could be sweeter. There's a lot of upheavals in that song. And I think that contrast of the sort of heaving, noisy guitars surging up from underneath, like the Loch Ness monster feeling to the middle of that song, and then it resolves. It's part of what makes them so remarkable to me. I watched the Eclipse concert, and it seems like they managed to reproduce all of these crazy studio things live, which was impressive.
I watched some clips of the Eclipse show that they played, which was also Ezra's 40th birthday, which feels deliberate and auspicious and purposeful. But I've been constantly impressed by, I think, their ambition as a live band. They work with a really excellent producer. They do things in the studio that feel very savvy and sophisticated, but they don't really let it slide when they go on stage. I think they're trying to sort of bring all of those complicated interlocking melodies, rhythms, patterns. They're really trying to make them work in a live setting, which I find incredibly impressive, although not as impressive as Ezra's vintage Blind Melon t-shirt that he was wearing at the Eclipse concert. I would pay good money for that t-shirt.
Calling eBay.
Yeah.
During the Goose Jam, speaking of t-shirt lore, he was wearing a t-shirt that said Free Mary Boone.
Oh, that's incredible.
Let's talk a little about The Surfer, which was the kind of skulking music that we started with way back, which feels like their homage to the Beatles.
Yeah, I love the horns on that track. That's also Rostam, former member of the band, coming back to produce, and maybe was also a co-writer on that track, if I remember it correctly.
Actually, here's the story. They've been working on that song. It's part of the archaeological generations of this album. There was a song that there was a collaboration with Rostam, and it was a totally different melody, but it had enough of the song, so they kept Rostam in the credits. So this is another like recycled element from the hard drive somewhere in the past.
I think that shows with kind of the beginning that sounds like a hip hop sample, uncredited. So I don't know what it is or if it's just something they've chopped up from their own recordings, but that to me felt like a bit of a Rostam signature.
Could be. I was not able to isolate the strain, the Rostam strain. One thing that's impressed me through the years is that they've gotten more contrapuntal as they've progressed. The ska punk thing at the beginning was syncopated chords, and now there's many more counter melodies that they all try to reproduce on stage. The bass lines are contrapuntal, the keyboards are and guitars are diverging. It seems like much more intricate, and they were pretty intricate to start with.
I don't think about it as sophisticatedly as you're putting it, but I think it's inherent in how they write songs that when they're first starting, they were called Baroque pop and chamber pop and all that, that you have this connection back to, you know, the history of Western music, and that they're just these melodies that feel whole and complete, and you want to embrace them. And I think it speaks to how they've matured too, that it's so much of it is a songwriting project, and that's an important part of it. Instead of just going out there and jamming songs, it doesn't ever feel like these are rough sketches come to life. It feels like every little piece of it has been considered. And even noticing those small details, I think, is what Ezra would want us to take away from this record more than anything.
Speaking of jamming, they've been hinting at Vampire Weekend's inner jam band. And in fact, when I talked to Thompson, he was wearing a fish t-shirt to go with your Blind Melon t-shirt, Amanda. But the idea that they're going to have a jam band within Vampire Weekend is kind of great.
I will say, so Father of the Bride kind of largely considered their jam band moment, their jam band record. I think when I first heard that album, or when I maybe read something that sort of speaked about its conception in that way, I thought, oh, they're being a little contrarian, right? It's like a hard left turn into what is the most deeply uncool music a band could embrace at that moment in time. And then I was just shocked by how well it worked with the way that they write songs. I love the idea that they have like a little secret internal jam band that's maybe going to show up at Bonnaroo or whatever, 3 o'clock in the morning on the campfire stage and play a 45-minute Eyes of the World or whatever it might be. I think it makes sense for Vampire Weekend in a funny way.
The backstory Ezra was inventing for them was a 90s band that was between jam and punk with footnote to the Minutemen.
I mean, that kind of just describes Vampire Weekend, doesn't it? A little bit.
This is a band that was made for footnotes, keeping us critics in business, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that because I'm an enormous nerd. I love the sort of parsing of the lyrical references, these kind of arcane, you know, the water tunnel number 3. I love that work that you get a little bit of homework with a Vampire Weekend record. I think it's a lot of fun. And I think they're also, you know, when they first came out, there was all this chatter. It felt so significant that they were formed at Columbia, you know, in the early 2000s. But I think there is this sort of Ivy League thread, like it's a little bit highbrow. There's a lot of multisyllabic words. There's arcane references. There is this sort of thing, this kind of academic thing that happens in their work that I think is intriguing. I think it's fun.
Well, besides the polysyllables, no three-syllable phrase is safe.
Yeah.
Diane Young, Jenna Copps, Hannah Hunt, especially three-syllable names, Mary Boone.
I mean, they also love a thing that sounds like something else. There's a word for that I'm forgetting. Synecdoche, is that it? You know, Ice Cream Piano, you know, Yahey. There's a million of them in their discography. Diane Young, you know, a thing that sort of sounds like another thing.
Homophones.
Ah, yes. Okay. Thank you, John. Fact checking, cuz. Sorry, Vampire Weekend. We're all such big fans. I'm curious, again, at Vampire Weekend, truly one of my favorite bands. I will love them to the end. I think they are great. I get incredibly excited when I hear there's a new record coming out. But I'm curious if there's eras or songs that don't work for you guys. Vampire misfires.
Quick answer is no. I can always contort myself into thinking something they're doing is great. The amount of people I've had to defend Father of the Bride to is immeasurable. I think if there's one thing that sometimes can rub me the wrong way, and it's less so with music, but is just, and I love the self-awareness in general, but the self-awareness with the hyper-commercialism that kind of found itself peeking into their everything surrounding Father of the Bride, putting Sony Music on the cover, being very aware of themselves as a brand. I don't even want to say I dislike it, but it makes it harder to then defend them just because it feeds into exactly what people who might dislike them would get out of just, oh, they're smarmy, they're know-it-alls. But it's part of who they are is that they know they are a brand in a band and they represent something to people that they might not always try to intend with their music. Like you were saying earlier, John, with him having to clarify what Pravda meant in the song. They're going to create something and then it's the rest of the world who's going to perceive it.
I noticed at the Austin concert, they were still talking about, you know, pick up the merch, get the album. It's still part of the stage routine, which you do when you're an indie rock band playing the Bowery Ballroom, maybe, but you don't really have to send people to the merch table if you're filling an amphitheater.
Yeah.
I will say, to their credit, they got me off of buying new vinyl records, which is maybe against them trying to send people to the merch table. But I remember one time years ago, Ezra was like, yeah, buy the vinyl, buy the iTunes, it doesn't matter. The vinyl's just like a big CD. I was like, yeah, you're right. I'm just going to buy the CD.
Though they did put this out on vinyl, and it's apparently, even though it's just 10 songs, it's four sides because it goes a little bit over what they want for high fidelity.
Wow.
So hope is on a side of its own, like Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands.
Wow.
Such a lovely coda for the record. I'm just an absolute moron when it comes to vinyl. I'm such a fetishist. Is that a word? I don't know. But I think that song, which we've already talked about a little bit, but to me, it really feels like a very expert, very lovely summation of the whole kind of psychogeography of this thing. Like, it just, I know I said Mary Boone at Capricorn were my favorite songs, but I just want to ride hard for hope for a minute. I think it's a really beautiful sentiment and a perfect way to kind of summarize and close this record.
It's also a challenge for a band that does tight little 3-minute songs to sustain an 8-minute utterance. And I think they do that really well.
Yeah.
It thickens and it thins out. It gets orchestral and then it gets vulnerable. It's pretty impressive.
I love the line Ezra has in there. This is such a New York thing, too, where he says, I think it's something like, your bag fell down onto the tracks. I hope you let it go. Anyone who's ever ridden the New York subway has had that moment where they drop something out of the subway tracks. And I think to me, that lyric in a funny way encapsulates the sort of idea of aging or submitting to the things that are truly out of your control, understanding your limitations. Because, you know, when you're 21 and you drop your wallet onto the subway tracks, you think, oh, that's what, like 4 or 5 feet? Like, I can leap down there and grab my thing and scurry back up and it'll be fine. I'm not going to get hit by a subway train. And then, you know, you get a little bit older and you realize, oh my God, that would be the dumbest thing in the world to do. It's insane. I could die. It would inconvenience a million other people. That there's true sort of growth in that too. And it's a small little couplet, but I thought, oh, that contains so much. That contains so much of the kind of narrative of this record and of aging and of New York and of just all of it. And the fact that it's like a little bit of an insidery reference too also felt very of a piece with Vampire Weekend's whole thing.
And it's underground and it's in a tunnel.
Yeah, exactly. speaking to return to the water tunnel idea, a thing that resonated for me about that too was the sort of precarity of that project. Like when it's an amazing David Grant article from The New Yorker about the construction of the water tunnels in New York. And it makes you realize like how simple it would be for the, you know, entire city of New York to be cut off from its water supply. So there's a little bit of a danger and precarity built into that, built into any idea of a tunnel that I also thought was useful and smart to deploy as like a lyrical, you know, as an image, as a reoccurring image here.
I think that's a good place to wrap it up. I really want to thank Matthew Strauss from Pitchfork, Amanda Petrusich from The New Yorker, the Vampire Weekend Critic Fan Club. Every podcast ever is available at newyorktimes.com/podcast. Every episode of Podcast Deluxe with John Caramanica and Joe Coscarelli is on YouTube at youtube.com/podcast. Please like, subscribe anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. I'm John Pareles, and let's go out with some hope. The sentencing was overturned. The killer freed the court adjourned. A hope betrayed, a lesson learned. I hope you'd let it go. I did the things you asked me to. I testified what wasn't true. But now I lost my faith in you.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.